Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Now we'll ask the question, should America just legalize marijuana already? We'll get two views and compare different legalization scenarios with two contributors to a new book called Marijuana Legalization, What Everyone Needs to Know. With us are Jonathan Calkins, public policy professor at Carnegie Mellon University, and Mark Kleiman, public policy professor at UCLA, and author of books including Against Excess and When Brute Force Fails. They disagree on legalization, but agree on a lot of details. Professor Calkins, Professor Kleiman, thanks for doing this. Welcome to WNYC.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
And let's see. I think so far we just have you, Jonathan Calkins. And so why don't you give us an overview of what you're trying to do with this book? It seems to be a review of the scientific literature on everything from the impact of legalization to whether pot smokers enjoy Mozart more when they're stoned. So what's the goal of this paperback with the green cover, including a pot plant?
The goal is to inform, not to persuade. Marijuana legalization is a live policy topic. Three states will vote on it this November. There are a tremendous number of misunderstandings because of myths put forward by advocates on both sides, and we're simply trying to allow voters in those states and citizens throughout the country to have more informed opinions.
Now, you vote in the book against legalizing marijuana, mostly because of the impact on children of dependent users. So can we start by laying out that concern and how much more dependency you think there would be and what the impact would be on children?
Sure, but I want to be clear. 15 chapters of the book are not about what we believe based on our values. They're just our effort to put the facts out. At the very end, we tack on a short chapter to let readers know where we're coming from. The increase in use is very hard to predict because no industrialized jurisdiction has ever legalized commercial production large-scale for recreational use. So we're going beyond the data. But you would expect prices to fall a lot. We know that use goes up when prices go down, and that increase tends to be across the board. It's not only an increase in casual use, it also would be an increase in use by people who are abusing or are dependent.
And you suggest that most of what's wrong with marijuana policy can be fixed by reforming prohibition or pushing what you call middle path policies. What are the biggest things wrong with marijuana policy today, in your opinion? Did we lose Professor Calkins? Do we have Professor Kleiman?
Yes.
Okay. So, Jonathan Calkins, go ahead and answer that question, because you suggest that most of what's wrong with marijuana policy can be fixed by things short of full legalization. So tell us what you think is wrong with marijuana policy today.
Well, 800,000 arrests is too many. But we had far fewer than 800,000 arrests for marijuana 20 years ago, and marijuana was just as prohibited then. Likewise in incarceration, and most of the incarceration doesn't come from marijuana, but when people are critical of the drug war, they're rightly concerned about 500,000 people behind bars. But I say to conservative audiences, let's go back to a good old-fashioned Reagan-era prohibition. People will say, oh yeah, that sounds good. And I say that means letting 80% of these people out of prison. Nobody thinks that drugs were legal under the Reagan administration, but there were only 10 to 20% as many drug law violators behind bars. There's no need to have 500,000 people in prison in order to have a prohibition.
Including marijuana? That is, the number of people behind bars for marijuana-related crimes is much higher than it was in the Reagan administration?
Yeah. It's only 20 or 40,000. It's a small portion of the 500,000. But you don't have to have sentences be as long as they are in order for there to be a prohibition. One of the ways that we know this is lots of times when people say, stop the drug war, do what country X is doing, or country X is their favorite country from Europe, No country in Europe has legalized. Even the Netherlands is only allowing retail sale of 5 grams or less. Production, commercial scale, is still illegal in the Netherlands and in every other European country.
Now, Professor Kleiman, you endorse a specific kind of legalization that includes permission to grow your own and the creation of small not-for-profit co-ops, but still a ban on commerce. Can you talk about why that model and not full legalization and regulation like with alcohol?
Well, it seems to me that alcohol is the best argument against the alcohol model. So we have very big companies hiring very smart marketing people to get as many kids as possible hooked on booze. And they're doing a very good job at it, because any commercialized sale of an addictive product, the bulk of the consumption is the minority of the users who are in trouble. Right? So 80% of alcohol sold in the U.S. is sold to people who drink too much. About 60% of drinks in the U.S. are part of drinking binges. So the casual social alcohol user, it's not really an important part of the business model of Budweiser. If we had a marijuana company, it would have exactly the same incentives. And we would have, you know, Bud versus Bud Light on the Super Bowl, except to be a different kind of Bud. That doesn't really appeal to me. And it's not clear that under the Supreme Court's rules about commercial free speech, you could have a fully legal commercial product and not allow mass marketing of it. It's also not clear how much tax you would collect. And one of the arguments in the book is the natural cost of marijuana is very, very small. And so you'd need an enormous tax to maintain anything like the current price.
And your proposal, I see, involves keeping taxes high enough to keep prices at least half the current levels. And the reason you would want marijuana prices high is to discourage dependency?
Yes. I mean, there's an old ad I once saw for a fancy brand of scotch that said, if the difference between the cost of our scotch and ordinary scotch bothers you, you're drinking too much. Cannabis intoxication now, at the current prices, costs about 50 cents an hour. I don't think we really need to make it any cheaper than that. Right? I mean, the candy bar somebody eats because he's got the munchies costs more than the pot. I think that's plenty cheap enough. Now, the proposal I actually offered, the co-op process, mm-hmm. would actually probably have the product be pretty cheap, but not heavily marketed. So I would want high taxes if we went to a commercial system like the alcohol system. And I think there may be ways, which I hadn't thought of when we wrote the book, of actually collecting those taxes, because that's a very big challenge.
What kind of co-op is this? It's like a CSA or something?
It's like, you know, people buying shares in an organic farm, right? There's some guy who grows marijuana, and a bunch of people join an association that pays him to grow the marijuana, and he sends them a baggie every month. Look, this is currently in use in Spain. It's quasi-legal there. Nobody studied, you know, what the problems are, but there don't seem to be any egregious problems. It means that people have access to professionally grown marijuana without having to become gardeners themselves. But there's no salesman, and that seems to me like a not bad solution. You know, a very tightly regulated commercial market could also be a not bad solution.
So, Professor Calkins, it sounds like the holy grail here for people who think seriously about marijuana law reform is how to reduce the unnecessary and destructive incarceration levels that we have today while minimizing the increase in dependency and the ravages that causes for those people and their family members.
Precisely. I agree. I mean, a lot of people would add avoid a big increase in use by youth also, but yeah, that's right.
And so...
You might also add arrests to incarceration. That's a separate problem.
Arrests, but even without incarceration, you're saying?
Yeah. I mean, the guy who spends a night in jail, you know, before the judge sees him and puts him on probation, that night in jail is probably much more damaging than his marijuana use.
Listeners, you can call in with everything you always wanted to know about the science of marijuana and marijuana law, but had no one to ask. Now you do. My guests are public policy professors, not scientists, but they have reviewed the studies on what pot does and what marijuana law does and what public health impacts a change in the law might have, as well as other quality of life changes on those affected. So call up with your opinions and your questions. As Professor Calkins said before, their opinions about legalization are only the very tail end of the book. This book is actually laid out into, I think it's 149 separate questions about marijuana and marijuana law with very brief answers. So give us a call, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, and we'll take your calls for our two guests right after this. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with two of the contributors to a new book called Marijuana Legalization, What Everyone Needs to Know. They are Jonathan Calkins, public policy professor at Carnegie Mellon University, and Mark Kleiman, public policy professor at UCLA, and author of books including When Brute Force Fails, How to Have Less Crime and Less Punishment, and also a book called Against Excess. Let's go to our phones and talk to Jack in Manhattan. Jack, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. Brian, I have a quick question, a quick comment. My question is, if marijuana was legalized, then would there be a variety of pricing structures given the varying quality of marijuana sold on the market now? And I guess my comment is that another benefit of legalization would be to remove the stigma in the professional setting, or at least minimize it. I work at a big law firm, and I know lots of associates and some partners who smoke. And in private, when you're friendly with someone, you can bring it up. But as opposed to alcohol, it's something you can't even talk about in a professional setting with somebody you're not comfortable with. So I wonder how much that would change.
Thank you, Jack. So, Professor Kleiman, you want to take a shot at that?
Sure. There would naturally be pricing variation. We have very little idea how the market would shake out, and it partly depends on policy choices. You might expect a mass market and then a small connoisseur market the way we have with mass market beer and microbrew beer. Cannabis is different from beer because it differs not only in flavor but in psychoactive effect. And I don't think we have any idea what consumers would prefer in that sort of organized market or what they would be led to prefer by marketing. The pricing would partly depend on tax policy. Most of the price of marijuana, if it were legal, would be taxed. And so that's really a decision, not an outcome. It would be natural to price it roughly proportional to its content of the psychoactive agents, particularly THC. You might want to put a higher price on the more potent stuff, as we put a higher price on distilled whiskey as opposed to wine or beer. The point about stigma, I think, is correct and important. So that's the thing I would add to John's list of downsides of prohibition. There are some number of probably tens of millions of Americans who, you know, aside from parking illegally and maybe cheating on their income tax, don't break any other law, but are constantly lawbreakers because they're constantly in possession of marijuana. That seems to me like a very bad thing. And so not just relaxing the stigma on them, but allowing them to sort of rejoin the ranks of law-abiding citizens, I think would be a big benefit. The question is, how much would that change norms about marijuana use? And would it change it in the direction of more responsible use or more irresponsible use? And again, I don't think we've got a clue. We just don't know about what the world would look like if marijuana were a fully legal drug.
But you're raising
all
these.
Part of the reason we're both arguing for caution, and I think Bo Kilmer's point in that last chapter, which is whatever we do, we should try to make it reversible, seems to me like very good advice.
In other words, try and experiment somewhere and be ready to undo it if the downside turns out to be worse than the upside, or bigger than the upside. Jim in Brick, you're on WNYC. Hello, Jim.
Hi. I was just reading about California sort of being in the forefront of marijuana production, but unless the laws are addressed federally, then having a disparity between the states is almost an incentive for interstate activity and then more applicable federal interstate trafficking crimes.
Professor Calkins?
There's no question that if one of these three states votes to legalize in November, there will be a direct conflict between state and federal law, and that dynamic will shape what happens. We have an awful lot of interstate commerce right now. The majority of the marijuana consumed in the United States now comes from Mexico, and California being the second biggest producer. So the total amount that moves across state borders won't change so much. What's going to change is the choices that the federal government has about whether or not they respect the will of the voters in a state that legalizes, or whether or not they try to step in and replace the removed law enforcement. State and local police do about 90% of the arresting for sales and distribution right now. So if you just remove that 90% and the federal government makes no change, then the risks fall enormously for the producers. The federal government could try to make up some of that difference.
If the federal government wanted to continue to arrest marijuana users or producers under federal law because they don't like the fact that a state has legalized, is what you're saying?
Absolutely, they have that right. So the federal government can arrest even a medical user with a single joint in a state with medical marijuana, but they're traditionally confining themselves to pursuing cases of a couple hundred pounds or greater.
Mm-hmm.
And one of their tough choices is whether they stay at those high levels and ignore somebody producing 50 pounds at a time, or whether or not they move to lower levels of the distribution chain than they focused on in the past.
Right. But you mentioned Mexico. And along the U.S. border, as you know, there are the drug wars that are killing so many innocent people. And much of that is around the marijuana trade. So when you count...
Not really. It's mostly a myth.
You don't accept that?
Marijuana trade is about 20% of the export revenues in the Mexican DTOs. There's a figure that you sometimes see of 60%, but that's wrong. It's more like 20%. So it's not unimportant, but it's not most.
Notice that's of their export revenues to the U.S. They also have important revenues from selling drugs in Mexico and from things like extortion and kidnapping.
But
so the total share of the Mexican Drug Trafficking Organization revenues that come from cannabis sales to the U.S. is maybe 10%.
But then if marijuana were legal in the U.S., you don't think the violence from the black market would be reduced very much, either in Mexico or among gangs on the streets of American cities?
Well, definitely not gangs on the streets of American cities, because there's not that much violence associated with the marijuana trade within U.S. borders now. There presumably would be a salutary impact on violence in Mexico. But Mark and I are just saying don't expect a night and day change, because marijuana is not the dominant source of their revenues. It's not like the DTOs would go out of business if they lost that particular product line. You know, it helps. That's an argument in favor of legalization. But you just don't want to have unrealistic expectations for the extent to which it would hobble the Mexican DTOs.
Jonathan Calkins and Mark Kleiman, contributors to the book Marijuana Legalization, What Everyone Needs to Know. What were you going to add?
It is probably true, and this is the flip of the questioner's question, that if even one of these states legalized, that would very, very likely wipe out the Mexican export trade, because a state where production was legal under state law could probably outcompete Mexico in price and quality terms.
Gosh, and then they'd get very, very rich, considering the amount of use in the United States.
Would be the pressure on the federal government.
The farmers of marijuana under legalization wouldn't get rich because the price would drop. There wouldn't be big money to be made in the production. If there's full-scale legalization and you're looking to make money, my guess is it would be in bundling. The marijuana itself would be cheap, but add marijuana to brownies, add marijuana to beer, maybe have a retail establishment where you bring in customers and you're giving them an overall experience. But I think that the straight commodity of marijuana would become very cheap because it is so easy to grow if it's legal.
Luis, is it Maynwood, New Jersey?
Yes, it is.
Hey, Luis, thanks for calling.
You're very welcome. As a former 20-year tobacco user, I understand that marijuana is less addictive than tobacco. On the other hand, I'm a Uruguayan born. Uruguay is on the verge of accepting marijuana as legalized in the country, and the government is going to be in charge of selling it. What about adopting such a system here?
Are either of you familiar with that model in Uruguay?
Yep.
it doesn't exist yet. It's been proposed.
It's been proposed. Well, I think Mark and I would both agree that if you're going to legalize, the ideal way to do it, or one good way to do it, would be to have the government control the trade. That's one of the ways to prevent the prices from declining, reduce diversion, and so on. That almost certainly won't happen in the near term in the United States because the federal government is very unlikely to go along with legalization, and the state government can't do a full government-controlled model while it's still illegal in the federal government. So Mark referred earlier to the idea that he could design a good legalization system, and I agree that you can design them. I'm more skeptical that that's actually the system that we would get. So I think what Uruguay might be contemplating might be better than what, in fact, could be pulled off in the United States, at least in the short term.
David in Brooklyn with another public health concern. Hi, David.
Hi. You know, today's marijuana is not the marijuana, the weed that was smoked at Woodstock. And today, psychiatric emergency rooms are experiencing more and more users who go through what's called cannabis psychosis. And what's not being talked about in this conversation is the public health costs, not only in dollars, but in lives. If we loosen up the laws on marijuana, a lot of people are going to try it, and there has been new links to schizophrenia. That some people who would never experience schizophrenia in their lives, because of this new, potent, very strong hydromarijuana, it causes people to either experience schizophrenia or full psychosis. And none of this is being addressed in this argument, and I worry about the burden on society of the lives that are going to be ruined by marijuana use.
David, thank you for your call. And I think you deal with each of those questions in your book. Do you deal explicitly with the question of whether today's marijuana is actually stronger than in the Woodstock days, to use his example?
Yes, yes, we do, and yes, it is. And there's pretty good reason to think that more potent and higher THC to CBD ratio cannabis is, in fact, more dangerous. It's not clear that that's an argument against legalization rather than an argument for legalization, because you can clearly legalize and put a limit on potency. Or a lower limit on the ratio. I mean, what the caller described is correct, and it's happening today under the illicit market. So it seems to me there's a fairly strong case for saying, well, maybe we should try to go back to your grandfather's pod by legalizing and regulating. Now, John's completely right. Of course, the regulatory system might not do a very good job because it might get captured by the industry.
What about this phenomenon, Professor Calkins, of marijuana-induced schizophrenia? Is that common?
Oh boy, common is a tough word. I think it happens. What the advocates of legalization would say is that it isn't so common that it dominates the many benefits of legalization, but I do agree that there's greater awareness of this now than even half a dozen years ago, and it shows up on the ledger of pros and cons.
And in terms of the amount of money that would be spent on additional public health problems from legalization of marijuana, I noticed in the book, Professor Calkins, that you actually have an estimate that flows from an estimate of additional hours of intoxication, which is a pretty funny stat in a way, 15 to 30 billion hours of intoxication each year. I never thought of measuring this by the hour, but perhaps costing $100 billion a year, you estimate. Where does that figure come from?
Well, actually, the figure comes from an argument that things like the medical cost of treating the schizophrenia are not the highest stakes issues. So, as Mark has said, it's really hard to predict exactly what will happen, but you would guess that the additional budgetary cost of dealing with additional schizophrenia would be a cost that's in the hundreds of millions of dollars. And the point of the argument with 15 billion more hours of intoxication is, if you think that intoxication represents additional happiness and you value that entertainment and all the other aspects of benefit that it would bring to users who enjoy it, at even something like $5 or $10 an hour, you're talking about a benefit in the many tens of billions of dollars. Likewise, if you think marijuana intoxication is intrinsically bad and you think you'd be willing to pay $5 or $10 to avoid extra hours of intoxication throughout society, then the sort of monetization of that big increase in intoxication dwarfs the concern about medical costs of schizophrenia.
We are basically out of time. I want to thank you for this conversation. I think this has been a very sober conversation about marijuana intoxication and looking at the shades of gray of legalization scenarios, which is exactly what you do in your book, very much outside of the usual yes-no kind of debate that would take place in the media. We just have literally 15 seconds, Professor Kleinman, but what do you hope comes of this book?
I hope that people realize this is complicated. And one complication we haven't mentioned, we ought to mention, is the effect of legalizing marijuana on alcohol, which is very likely important, and we have no idea whether it's going to be more heavy drinking or less heavy drinking.
All right.
This stuff is hard.
Jonathan Calkins and Mark Kleinman are contributors to the book Marijuana Legalization, What Everyone Needs to Know. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.